You open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
This is what I long for. This is my goal, is to have my books affect people in a way that will last.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. On today's program, Debbie Maycomber's Cedar Cove series has been turned into a TV show on the Hallmark Channel. And while filming the show one day, a young man working on the set came up to her.
And he said, "I want to thank you. Because of you, I have a job." So, you know, who would have ever believed that something, this little story that was going around in my head, would have all of these rippling effects on others, you know? So I thank God for that.
Debbie Maycomber has more than 170 million copies of her books in print worldwide. She's written best-selling cookbooks, inspirational and nonfiction works, and children's books. This hour, she talks with Ron Hogan, an editor at Reagan Arts Publishing in New York City.
One of the things that I learned about you this afternoon as we were all talking around the sound check and the receptions is that you were introduced to books at a very young age by somebody who turned out to, it turned out to be like quite a surprising person to have become a guardian angel. Let's tell that story.
Well, I was born and raised in Yakima, Washington, which I hate to say this is the apple capital of the world. I know Michigan has its own apples. And my mom took me to the library. I was, I think, about 4 or 5 years old, and the children's librarian gave me my first book. The only thing I had to that point were the golden books. And my mom said that when I was handed the book, I grabbed hold of it with both hands and put it right next to my heart. And from that point forward, I would never go to bed without a book. And I'm that way today. But the great part of that is the librarian who gave me the book was Beverly Cleary.
And as you grew up, what sort of prompted you to make the leap from being somebody who loved to read to being somebody who turned to writing?
Well, I struggled with reading. It was because I loved stories so much. It was a real disappointment that I couldn't learn to read. I didn't learn to read till I was 10 years old because I'm dyslexic. But they didn't have a word for it then. And I can remember the third grade teacher telling my mother, "Debbie's a nice little girl, but she's never going to do well in school." And I really didn't. I feel fortunate to have graduated from high school. In fact, I married as a teenager because those were the, you know, there was not very many options left to me. I happen to like Wayne, so. No, but I had this dream about being a writer. And I'd never told anybody because it's such a powerful dream and seems so unlikely. I'm really a storyteller. But I told the principal when I was at high school. She asked me what I was going to do after high school, and I said, "I'm going to write books." And it was the first time I'd ever said it to anybody. And she patted me. I burst into tears. I mean, it was so, you know, to say it out loud. And she patted me on the shoulder and sent me home. She said, "You really need to think about something you could do, Debbie." Yeah. So.
You ever go back to that high school?
Actually, the principal did live long enough to see my published books. Ooh. Yeah.
And what were some of your first published books?
Well, I wrote 4 books all the way through. And like I said, I'm a storyteller. All 4 of those books sold. I had to rewrite them because I had to learn to be a writer. The stories were always good. But I had, so the very first book I sold was a book called Heart Song. But right away after that, I sold another book called Starlight. And then they published Starlight first. So the first sale was Heart Song. The first published was Starlight.
And one of the things that I found fascinating as I was like doing my research and finding out more about you is that one, you have so many books, but two, I mean, like most writers are fortunate if they have sort of like one franchise series in the course of their career. And you are somebody who has had like a couple different sort of like big series. Some of them are tied to specific places. And, you know, I think you were probably like one of the first romance or women's fiction writers to really sort of like have like an annual, a Christmas story as like a big sort of like annual tradition sort of thing. And so, well, let's start with Cedar Cove, because I think that's probably like one of the ones that most people are familiar with. Mm-hmm. And how did the idea of the stories of Cedar Cove sort of like come together for you? Like what made that sort of like a setting where you would tell stories in?
Well, I had done a number of series before then, and I did six books set in Alaska, six books set in Texas, and these were all published as category romances. And it's funny because they've been reissued since then, and they make the times list, and you know, nobody would ever realize that they were published as Harlequin romances when they started out. But the readers have been the driving force. It's you. You have been the driving force of my career. I read every single piece of mail that comes into my office. And it's because of the readers that I did the Cedar Cove series. I would get letters. I still get letters. I mean, 20 years after they're published, whatever happened to, could you go back and tell us what? And going back on a series that's been completed is sort of like dating an old boyfriend. You're like, done with that? You know? So I thought, you know, they wanted to go back. I had a hard time saying goodbye to these characters. So I thought, I will create a series that that is ongoing. I didn't know how many books were going to be in it. I was just keep writing until all the stories were told. And it was, and I'll give you another example of how the readers, the cookbooks came about from the readers, because anytime I would mention a recipe in a book, my office would get flooded with mail. Could you share that recipe? And so that was how that, and the Christmas books too. My original Christmas story was 100 pages, and the readers said, love you, love the story, but I want more. And I was contracted for three more, but I didn't get a penny more, but I doubled the word length. Yeah, and that's from the feedback from the readers.
And you sounds like you get a lot of feedback from the readers on a lot of different things every day.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked this question. I just happen to have a list. These are honest to goodness letters I have received from my readers. And I mean, I love getting mail. And so I've kept some of the best letters that the love I received. I love your book so much, I'm willing to pay for them. I assume she was a library patron. And then, as I said, I continue to get mail all the time about the series I've written. And this one lady wrote, she says, when is that next Rose Harbor book coming out? I'm 85. Hurry! Now, as I said, I never went to college, and so, but I like to think that I'm self-taught. But I got this letter that said, I like you best because you use small words. And this is one of my favorites. You're my favorite author. You put me to sleep every night. You don't need that AM, PM stuff, you know, or the PM bill. Just read one of my books. And this is a letter that actually came from my editor, and she, God bless her, forwarded on. And I don't remember if it was typed or written, but I do remember it was 3 pages long. And on the left-hand side, she put the title of the story, and on the right-hand side, she put all the ways she thought I could improve the story. And the last line of her letter said, in fact, I have read every one of Debbie May Cumber's books, and I haven't liked one of them. I just told her, keep buying the books. I'll try harder.
Yeah.
And I have gotten proposals of marriage. And this lady wrote me. She was from St. Louis. And she actually heard I was in town and tracked me down and called me in my hotel room and told me that I sounded like such a nice person, just the kind of woman she wanted her son to marry, and he was 52 and lives at home. Was I interested? And then another letter I got is the lady said, I will buy anything that has your name on it. So thank you, Betty. I don't quite know who she's reading, but now my favorite all-time letter came from a man in prison. Now, if your mailing address is on anything that goes into prison, trust me, you will get mail. And most of them are just silver-tongued devils. You know, the way they've survived is they learn how to manipulate. And so they will say anything, you know, that they really think you will respond to. And this guy apparently did not get the memo because his letter to me said, you can be my woman. I don't even care that you're fat. Now, I didn't waste that letter. I took it home to Wayne and I waved it under his nose. And I said, I could have this guy.
But between that guy and the 52-year-old living at home in St. Louis, did you?
I tracked them all.
Yeah, so Wayne sounds like he's an incredibly patient and understanding man.
Wayne is the greatest guy. Two of his cousins are up here. They're up in the balcony there somewhere. And I spent the last couple of days with them. And he is the funniest guy. I was on tour for a book called 20 Wishes, and the publisher sent me to 20 cities. And he said, Debbie, if you'd have titled that book Three Wishes, you'd have been home a long time ago. And I signed us up for ballroom dancing classes. And now I have, you know, climbed mountains for this man. I have sailed the seas. I've ridden motorcycles. I've done all this stuff. By golly, you could take a ballroom dancing class. So, but he just balked. You would have thought I was asking him to run down the street naked. You know, he was just... And so finally, the day of the class, he says, all right, Debbie, what's it going to cost me to buy my way out of this? I want you to look at this ring, girls. Yeah. He was rubbing my back down the other day. We swim, and my back gets real dry. So he's rubbing it down, and he says, honey, you're getting an hourglass figure. Okay, an hour and 15 minutes. So that tells you a little bit about Wayne.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things that I learned today is they were telling me about how you had gotten an idea for a story recently, but then you right away said it's like, oh, well, you know, okay, I've got this idea for a story now. I guess I'll write it sometime next March.
That's true.
And why wait like 10 months to
do the story?
To do the story.
Because I have two books to write before then. It'll take me that long to get to it.
Yeah. So how do you sort of like schedule or organize, like, because I mean I know you've got like all sorts of ongoing things and doing several books a year. And how do you keep all that straight?
Well, I have a wonderful office staff and an assistant, Renata, who's been with me for 21 years, so they really help me. But when I get a story idea, I have to, because I'm a storyteller, I can get story ideas every day. And they're just natural to me. And so I had to come up early in my career with a way to decide which story I was going to write. And so I came up with five words. The first one is relevant. It has to be relevant to my reader's life, and I know my audience. It has to be provocative. I want my reader to think. It has to be told in the most entertaining way possible. I'm not here to preach or to spout off anything. It's just entertaining. It has to be truthful and honest in a way that it doesn't makes sense that the book would end the way it did, and it has to be told in the most creative way possible.
Cool. With that in mind, let's talk a little bit about your most recent book, Last One Home, and what was the initial inspiration for that?
I'd gone to a charity event for Habitat for Humanity, and we were escorted. It was a hoedown, so Wayne and I, you know, we had our hoedown outfits on, and we were escorted to the table, and the people that were, the young woman who was escorting us had on her shirt, future homeowner. And I asked her what that meant, and she explained to me that she was working to build a home for her family. Her husband had left her, and she had two small children, and they didn't have a home. They were living in this really crappy apartment. And so Habitat for Humanity had given them a step up, and she was working 500 hours, equity hours, to build this home. And so I created a story around somebody who was building a home and making a new life for herself.
And you had mentioned before that some of the earliest books that you had done, the ones that are coming out again now, were category romances.
Yes.
And I know that sort of now a lot of what you do is sort of officially categorized as women's fiction. And I'm always sort of curious about what the sort of like official distinction is. You know, what makes one book a romance, let's say, and another sort of like a women's fiction novel?
Well, I think romance just, concentrates on a relationship between a man and a woman. So it's just strictly the romance and the story of that romance. Women's fiction, and it just as I got older, it was harder for me to write about a 25-year-old or a 20-year-old falling in love. And, you know, there were a lot more issues going on. So it's more about, there's always romance in it. And you'll find that in just about every genre. Mm-hmm. There's always romance in it. But the story is not central. The romance is not central to the story. It's like in the book, Last One Home, it's Cassie who's finding her way home. She's reconciling with her family, with her sisters. She's building a home. She's creating an environment for her daughter.
Yeah, and there is a romantic relationship as a part of that.
Right.
But, I mean, as you said, there's a lot more going on in Cassie's relationship life, and there's other elements to the story as well. But it also sort of seems to me that, I mean, writers like you are in a nice position in that it's like your romance fans have followed you.
They're getting older too.
because I know there's, I know there are some people who are like, you know, romance or nothing. But it seems like, I mean, a lot of the folks that I like to read and a lot of the folks that I like to take recommendations from in this field are people who, you know, recognize that it's like whether something is strictly sort of like category romance or whether it works in those broader things, that those sorts of like relationship dynamics and those character, you know, the ways that characters and people relate to each other are really key to telling a good story.
It is, and I think probably that you have to make it relatable. You know, like I said, the reader has to relate to the characters, no matter if it's romance or women's fiction. That's important.
Now, you had also mentioned cookbooks as something that you do, and
I always knew being a frequent eater would pay off.
But you know that there are other aspects of the things that you do outside of writing the fiction as well. And it's funny because like when I told my wife, for example, that I was coming out to Michigan to interview you, she was like, "Oh, say hi. You know, Debbie's a knitter." And I guess she had seen you at like one of the Stitches conventions and stuff. So,
oh yeah, I love Stitches.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about knitting and how that sort of like has, how it's become, you know, not just a private passion for you, but something that you've been sharing with your readers and others as well.
Well, like I said, I didn't learn to read till I was 10. So knitting actually saved me as a child. I was always at the bottom of my class and always struggling, and I really needed some self-esteem, and knitting gave that to me. It helped me in it tremendously. You know, I guess God brought that into my life as a little girl to save me, because I just was so down and beaten down and feeling like I was really stupid. And so when I learned to knit, I learned how to concentrate. My comprehension skills got much better because I had to study the pattern and learn the pattern. And then I learned mathematical skills because I had to figure out the stitches and decreases and things like that. And that self-esteem, that sense of accomplishment were so, when I was in, probably the highlight of all of my school years was when I was in the eighth grade, the teacher learned that I knit, and I showed her some of the things, and she was so impressed with the things that I knit that she had me show them to the class. And for somebody that was at the very bottom of the class, that was a highlight moment. And I knit to this day, and I should tell you, I have a grandmother. I never knew her. She died before I have any memories of her. But my older cousins talk about her and her rocking chair. She crocheted, and they would sit in a semicircle and watch her, and she would be rocking back and forth and just crocheting so fast her hands would just keep moving, and she was snoring sound asleep.
What sort of projects do you work on mostly these days?
Oh, I knit everything. I go through kind of stages. I'm doing lace shawls right now, but I'm knitting a vest. That's what I have with me on for the airplane. So, you know, I've knit socks. I've knit sweaters. I've knit, yeah. One of the children's books, the title is The Truly Terrible, Horrible, Awful Sweater Grandma Knit. Yeah, based on a true story.
So there's the inspiration for that one. But what Sort of what did sort of inspire you to write children's books in general?
Just that idea. I was talking to a friend, and she writes children's books, and she was kind of in a slump, and I said, well, you know, I kind of have an idea for a book and for a kid's book, and so we wrote it together. She had the experience in how to do it best. So yeah, but most of my inspiration comes from two house payments.
Now you're writing pretty much round the clock in order to. You have like a really phenomenal publishing schedule in terms of how many books a year come out. Do you have much time to read other folks?
Oh yeah, I'm an avid reader. Mm-hmm. Avid reader. I've learned. Mm-hmm. I've learned how to read. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what sort of things do you read for fun?
I read a lot of romance. I read a lot of nonfiction. I'm always right now. I try to keep up with what's really popular on the Times list. I'm just finishing All the Light We Do Not See. So, and there is a wonderful book that was the last book, a big book I read, and I listen to a lot of audiobooks. One of the problems with being an author is because I create books, I know books, and if there's something off, the timing is off, the characterization is off, I get very critical. So I listen to a lot of audiobooks. And so The Boys in the Boat, it's a wonderful, wonderful book. I don't know if it's about the University of Washington in 1936. Team. Yeah. Row team. Mm-hmm. Yeah, rowing, I guess. Yeah.
So who are some of your favorite romance writers?
Well, you mentioned two, Eloisa James and Julia Quinn. I enjoy the historical Mary Bailo. Okay. Really good friends. I read all my friends' books. So Linda Lale Miller. She lived next door to me for years. Then she moved. She said the neighborhood was going downhill. just she came to see me this winter in Florida. I'd had surgery on my foot, so I was 12 weeks in a cast and 6 of those weeks in a wheelchair. And so I hadn't gone out of the house. Getting out of the house was, and so she said, "You're getting out of the house." So we went to Chico's, and she was pushing my wheelchair in, and she gets to the door, and she goes, "Wide load coming through." I want to tell you about Washington State and Cedar Cove, because Cedar Cove is based on where Wayne and I have lived for the last 30 years, and it's Port Orchard, Washington, and I had such a funny experience there just recently. I just want to tell you about it. Well, first of all, to explain Port Orchard, I guess the best way to tell you is that the dollar store recently had a sale. But there's a Chinese laundryman, and I take my things into his laundry cleaners, and he has a name that begins with an X, and I swear it's this long. And I'm, because I'm dyslexic, I really struggle with foreign words and foreign languages. And when he saw me, he got the biggest smile on his face, and he says, "I choose American name." And I said, "Oh, I'm so glad. What's your American name?" He goes, "Jose!" That tells you everything I can tell you about Port Orchard.
So now, obviously, like the folks in Port Orchard, Washington, know that you've based a series on them. So what's it like, sort of like being, you know, going around, you know, as the one who sort of like created a series of novels around the town?
Well, you know, I've lived there for 30 years. I'm just, you know, I swim in the morning at the high school with a bunch of friends. It's not, you know, I don't get any respect. I'm just one of them, you know. Okay. They kind of do it. Oh, I want to tell the story about going into the restaurant too. Mm-hmm. I was at a restaurant it was actually one of the Stitches conferences, mm-hmm. and I had my name tag on me to forget you have them. And I went into the restaurant, and the waitress came up, and she looked at me, and she looked at the name tag. She said, "Oh my goodness, you have the same name as my favorite author." Now, it is really hard to look like your publicity photo, I want to tell you that.
So did you break it to her?
I didn't, but my friend did. So, and I had ordered soup, and she brought it back, and my friend says, "Well, you know, this is Debbie McGovern." She went, "Oh my goodness," and she nearly spilled the soup on my lap.
Now, when Hallmark came around and started making the Cedar Cove, so did they come to Port Orchard, or is that filmed someplace else?
Oh, I really, really tried to get them to film it in. It's filmed actually in Vancouver. Vancouver is Hollywood North. There are 35 television series filmed in Vancouver alone. Mm-hmm. And but I really tried to get it filmed in Washington State, and worked with our state legislature, and they were willing to give the same tax credits. Unfortunately, we just don't have the infrastructure for it there. They just couldn't do it. They were mm-hmm. so willing to, but they just wasn't there.
Yeah. No, but Dad, did you get to go up to the set in Vancouver and sort of be involved with it?
Yeah, I'm an executive producer, okay. So I do get to go up to the set and I read the scripts and I'm an advisor on the scripts. And I've met all the casts, and I've had two really wonderful experiences. One was when I was up there. I actually got tears in my eyes with this. I was kind of, they was watching the scene being filmed, and a young man who was hauling, you know, the cameraman was there, but the guy behind him was holding all the cords, and he was standing there, and he looked over at me, and he said, I understand you wrote this series. And I said, yeah, this is so exciting to me. And he said, I want to thank you. Because of you, I have a job. You know? So, you know, who would have ever believed that something, this little story that was going around in my head, would have all of these rippling effects on others, you know? So I thank God for that, yeah.
And that actually brings us to something else that we were sort of talking about earlier before, is that, I mean, you know, you have like a tremendous level of success. And as you say, it's, you know, it's not just your success, but it does things like it creates jobs in television, you know, it keeps publishing houses afloat.
editors like you.
editors like you, publicists like you. How do you stay humble in the face of like such great successes?
Oh my goodness, God keeps me humble, he really does. I was telling him earlier, I was in Hong Kong there was, the story about the gal in the restaurant, you know, we have the same name. I was in Hong Kong, and Chinese women are so beautiful and delicate and petite and graceful, and I'm just not any of those things. I'm standing in Stanley Market, and this beautiful Chinese woman jumps out and points at me and says, "We got sizes fit even you." Yeah. Yeah. I know it. The letters keep me humble. The readers keep me humble. I was autographing books one time in a grocery store. They send us odd places sometimes, and I was in the frozen pea section. And I actually sold more frozen goods than I sold books.
Now, but you've had all this success, and certainly your children have, you know, grown up watching you as a writer. Did they ever sort of come to you and say, "Mom, we want to be a writer too"? Or?
Well, I think any one of them could be a writer. They're all very creative and fun, but they don't have the passion. And if you want to be a writer, you really have to have the passion, and they don't. But I think my 8-year-old grandson is a natural-born writer. Now, remember, he's only 8. He was... his school was vandalized, and he was so upset about it. He did what's natural for an author. He sat down and he wrote a story about it. And in his story, he was instrumental in capturing the culprits. And the last line of his story is, "And when they got out of jail, they were too old for bingo." Yeah. Now, I thought that was a really good line.
Yeah, that's a good line.
You know? So I said, "James, can Grandma use that line?" Now, here's the test of a real writer. He said, "If you pay me."
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, Debbie Maycumber talks about her long road to becoming a writer.
Thank you.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. The National Writer Series is a year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We go back now to Ron Hogan's conversation with novelist Debbie May Cumber.
Now, you had, one of the letters that you talked about before was from the woman who was like, yo, hurry up and get the next Rose Harbor thing that I made. But like, on a broader level, what's the maybe the one series or the one sort of like type of book that fans are like, you know, come back and do more of those? Or
I think every series, they, you know, if they read them, they really, really like them. And it's natural because I don't want to let go of those characters either. So, but I'm kind of going away from this series now because one book a year, it's become now, I've noticed, having read from the Kindles, they come out like every month and the readers don't want to wait. And so I'm kind of leaning towards doing just one hardcover a year and a Christmas book. Uh-oh. Sorry. Grumbling in the peanut gallery down here.
And what's a typical writing day like for you? Like how do you, I mean, we talked a little bit about how you manage the types of things that you do on a broad scale basis, but like on a day-to-day basis, how does that work for you?
I'm pretty disciplined when it comes to my writing schedule. And I'll tell you my day, I'm a farmer's granddaughter. And I'm just a natural morning person. I just love mornings. I wake up cheerful. And when Wayne and I were first married, he used to say, you have to wake up so bright. Poor guy. So I get up around 4 in the morning. And I first thing I do then is sit down with my journals and my Bible. And I do about 2 hours of Bible reading. And I'm at Bible reading and journal writing. Now, my first sale was my brother and 2 of my cousins made copies of my 8th grade diary and sold it to the boys in my class. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it was traumatic at the time, just traumatic. I ran away from home. It was horrible. It was just horrible. But now as I think back, it sold really well. So then I go to the pool and I swim a half a mile. That's 30 laps. And go home, change clothes, and have breakfast, and head to the office. I ride away from the home, and I have a staff of 7. And when I start a book, I take a calendar page, and I write down how many pages a day I need to write in order to make my deadline. And I don't go home until those pages are done. And that's usually around 5 o'clock. It takes me until 10 o'clock to read the mail, answer emails, and stuff like that.
Okay. And then it's back to bed and up at 4 the next morning.
Yes, yeah. But it's to bed early.
Yeah. So how many pages does that usually come out to?
Between 10 and 20, just depends on the schedule and mm-hmm. what I've got going. And I take Wednesdays off. I found I was leaving the office early every day for appointments, and I couldn't ever get an appointment with my doctor on a Wednesday, and he takes Wednesdays off. And I thought, that is a really good idea. So I do all my appointments on Wednesdays. So, yeah.
Cool. Now, you mentioned that you start the day with 2 days of Bible study and Bible reading. And I think, like, one of the things about your fiction is that, and I know you've done, like, outright inspirational works in both fiction, but even in the sort of, like, the secular fiction, let's say, I mean, it's clearly driven by your faith and your beliefs, but not in a way that overwhelms the story itself or that threatens to sort of like make the story itself take a back seat.
Well, it's like I have brown eyes. Yeah. You can't separate the fact I have brown eyes. I'm a Christian, mm-hmm. you know, so yeah. I don't make any qualms about it.
Yeah, no, well, I think it's more in the sense that it's like, I mean, there's a certain type of Christian fiction that it's like where it's very
preachy
yeah. exactly
yeah.
that it's like and for me it's like, I mean, the types of like we were talking before about how like I actually am a big fan of Amish romances and one of the things I love about it about the best Amish romances is that the religious community that they're in, the religious life that they lead, is simply a backdrop to
the story itself.
And it's like it infuses and it informs every aspect of the characters' lives, but they don't sit around and talk to each other about it in ways that are clearly intended to be, you know, the author talking to the reader.
Yeah.
And that's something that you don't do either.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, I did want to tell you how I got started, just because it's such a great story of how God has led me in my life. And like I said, I always wanted to write novels from the time that I can even remember. I was making up stories when I went to sleep at night. But that was a dream I just held so close to my heart that I didn't tell anybody until I had a cousin who died. He had leukemia. We grew up together. We were just a couple of months apart in birth, and I was very close to him. And I tell the story at writers' conferences a lot, but I went to the hospital. I was living in Seattle. He was in Yakima, and he got so sick they brought him to a hospital in Seattle, and I went to see him, and I got lost in the hospital, and I asked a doctor, how do I get from here to there? And he said, well, you go right down the corridor, take the first right, go all the way to the end, and walk through the door marked absolutely no admittance. and that's what, you know, when you have a dream sometimes, that's what you have to do. You have to be able to walk through that door. And just before we came on stage, I was doing an interview with a local NBC affiliate, and I was trying to explain to them that, you know, wanting to be a writer, when you hurt yourself, you can throb with pain. But when I thought about writing books, I throbbed with joy. There was such a happy anticipation. Well, after David died, I told Wynn I really want to try this, and he was very supportive. And we went and rented a typewriter. We couldn't afford an electric one. It was too much. We couldn't afford a typewriter, but with four little kids and a one-family income, you know, one person working. So we rented a typewriter. I put it on the kitchen table. I moved it at meal times, and I wrote for 2.5 years. And I was, you know, I think back now, I was felt really guilty because I was taking $100 a month out of our family budget to be the writer, and I wasn't contributing a penny. And I realize now I was teaching our kids some of the most valuable lessons of their youth. You know, I was teaching them about, you know, having determination to believe in yourself and not to give up. And about 2.5 years, Wayne came to me. He had gone through a construction electrician, a period of unemployment, and he came after paying bills, and he said, honey, I am so sorry, but we are not making it. And I really need you to get a job. And I had no job skills. I mean, I married so young. I was still a teenager. I could fold a crisp diaper, you know, but that was it. So I was going to apply for 3 jobs the next day that I thought I could probably get. But my heart was just so heavy because I knew I couldn't do it all. You know, with the kids, they were in sports and scouts and music and dance and, you know, all their different activities, work 40 hours a week, keep up the house. Something was going to have to go, and it was the writing. So I went to bed that night with such a heavy heart, and I said, well, God, you gave me this dream. Just take it away. Take it away, because I can't do it. And so Wayne woke up about 3 or 4 in the morning, and he said, are you awake? And I says, you know, honey, I haven't been asleep yet. And he says, well, what's wrong? And I said, you know, I really think I could have made it as a writer. I do. And he didn't say anything for a long time. And then he sat up and he turned on the light and he said, honey, go for it. Go for it. So, you know, I wish I could say I'm just so talented that I sold right away. I didn't. It was another 2.5 years. But I felt like I had to at least contribute what I was taking away from our family. So I started selling little articles, and I'll tell you the first thing I sold. Dale, our youngest, was in the Christmas program at church, and his entire role was to step forward, recite his Bible verse, and step back. And he did a really good job, excepting he forgot the reference. And this, you know, poor little kitty, like, looks to me like, help me, Mom, help me. So I went, it's Luke. And Dale straightens his shoulders, and he goes, Luke Skywalker! Yeah, I got $5 for that, and it was such great validation. And then I started selling routinely, and I sold something to Women's Day magazine for $350. Mm-hmm. Now, that was a whole extra paycheck for us. Yep. And, you know, Wayne and I were trying to decide how we could possibly spend all this money. It's like, and Wayne very wisely said, well, why don't you attend a writer's conference? I had never met another writer, ever. And so I went, and there were two editors there that had agreed to critique 10 manuscripts. So I sent my manuscript in, and they agreed to critique mine. And I was so excited because I love this story. I thought if I ever sold it, it would be this story. I just loved it so much. And when I arrived there, there were like 400 writers in the room, and those of us that, the 10 of us who had been chosen, had a star on our badge. Oh my goodness, it was like I had a size 52 left breast. I, you know, it was like, I have got a star, you know. I was just so excited. And so the editor came up and she said, well, one of the manuscripts that I read shows a lot of promise. And I swear to you, it was all I could do not to raise my hand saying that would be me. Well, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. She had the whole room laughing at what she called the infeasibility of my plot. Well, I'm a storyteller. I knew I had to learn to be a writer. Mm-hmm. But if the story wasn't good, there was no way I was ever going to sell. But I was, you know, you just want to, you'll do anything. And I certainly was willing to do anything. So I went up to her afterwards, and I said, if I rewrote the story, would you give me another chance? Now, it's been over 30 years, and I will never forget the look that came in her eye. As she leaned forward, she put her hand on my arm and said, throw it away. Throw it away. When Wayne was going through another bout of unemployment, he was up in Alaska waiting to go out on the pipeline. And I sat up all night. I didn't even bother to go to bed. I just sat up all night. I was so depressed. And I went back the next day. I wanted a refund for the conference because we could use that money. We mm-hmm. could really use that money. We were living on $150 a week unemployment check. And they wouldn't give it to me, but everything I'd sold at this point had been articles about the kids. So I attended a kids' writing workshop, and the author said, every manuscript has a home. Your job is to find it. Now, taking that little itty bit of hope, I just grabbed onto it with both hands. I mean, that is all I needed. That was just that one little bit of hope. So, and I went right home, and I wrote a query letter to another publisher and mailed it off, and you enclose a self-addressed stamped envelope so that the query letter just says, I've written this wonderful book. Do you want to see it, yes or no? And they so now, if I've ever seen God's hand in my life, this is probably the most profound moment. Every day, I would look at that manuscript, and it would, as I was waiting for the reply, and it said, so you think you're going to be a writer? Debbie's a nice little girl, but she's never going to do well. All those ugly, negative voices that I grew up with were taunting me. And I thought, I don't care if they want to see it or not. I'm mailing it off. So I loaded the kids in the station wagon. We went down to the post office. And as I'm waiting in line, my stomach is in knots. I'm thinking, am I doing the right thing? You're living on $150 a week with four kids. They're going to school. They need clothes. And it's $10. And I remember when I got up to the postmaster, he said, you have to let go of the money. Let go! So I mailed it off. I came home, and Ted ran to the post box, and he said, Mom, that letter you've been waiting for, it's here. And I stood right in the middle of the street. I tore open the envelope, and in a Sharpie pen, the editor had written across the top of my query letter, do not mail us your envelope, and do not mail us your manuscript. We are not buying. Here I had just wasted $10. I went and I lay down in the Davenport, and I was depressed. Well, I hadn't had teenagers yet. I didn't know what real depression was. 3 weeks later, Simon & Schuster called and bought the book. If I had waited a half hour, I would never have mailed it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was how I got started writing. And you know, all four of the books that I wrote sold. I had to rewrite them, mm-hmm. but they were all good stories.
And has it been pretty, like, in moving forward, has there ever been a story that you've, like, written and then got into the end and been like, it hasn't worked, and you've had to sort of like put that one aside and start over again?
No.
No?
I've certainly had to do plenty of rewrites.
Okay.
Yeah, but not where I had to start over again. You know, there's just maybe a few things along the way.
And I guess too, it's like, I mean, at this point, it's not like you're writing on spec anymore. It's like,
I just send in a synopsis and we talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I just finished a really, really good book. It's going to be out next year at this time. It's called A Girl's Guide to Moving On.
So how does that sort of relationship with your editors work these days? I mean, you just said now that some of it's like you send in the synopsis but like on a practical level, like how are your relationships with publishers and editors?
Well, I'm new at Random House. I've been with them 4 years, and I actually work with two editors, which has been a real change. When I was with Harlequin, I had the same editor for almost 30 years. So it's been an interesting transition for me. Things are done very differently at Random House and with the two editors. One will they both read it and read the manuscript. Then one will give me the revisions, and then when I do the revisions, the other one will do the editing. So it's quite a different experience. It's been really great too.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is something about you or about your writing that would surprise your fans if they knew, but they don't know.
How?
Until now.
Well, when I'm in Florida, I write in an office that's just, it's a little library that I have. It's a very small office compared to what I have in Port Orchard, and Bogey sits on my feet. I guess that. Here's something that's probably a lot of people don't know. In my office in Port Orchard, I write in a turret. So as I walk up the turret, I have author signatures. I have Charles Dickens, Mark Twain, Jack London, Harriet Beecher Stowe. All of these are my mentors. Their books have lasted through the ages, and they're read today. And I'm reminded every time as I go up, the power of story. There's Pearl S. Buck's book there. I mean, think of Harriet Beecher Stowe. Look at the power for story, Uncle Tom's Cabin. America changed policy, foreign policy, with China, with Pearl S. Buck's book, A Good Earth. This is what I long for. This is my goal, is to have my books affect people in a way that will last for beyond the month. I used to say my books had the shelf life of cottage cheese. So that is my goal as an author. So every day when I walk up that, I am reminded of the importance of story.
You've been doing this for a long time, and the number of books that you've had, it stretches out. I think like one of the things that I've discovered I am still very much an active print book reader, but I have been reading more ebooks over the years, and it feels like you said, I mean, because the realities of the marketplace are in the limited amount of shelf space that bookstores often have and so forth, we're not that far off when we say our books have the shelf life of cottage cheese, because they're always like circulating in like newer stuff. But it feels like ebooks have changed that to a certain extent, because you don't have to like store them on a, the stores don't have to store them on a shelf, that it's like they can keep things available. So it's like, do you find that even say like fans who have come to you in more recent years are able sort of to dive into the backlist?
Yes, definitely. I can really see it, that there are more ebooks. I think it's more probably 60-40 now, more ebook sales.
Yeah. We met somebody in the reception before the event tonight, who had she had like the whole checklist, which was, I thought was pretty awesome. And it's like, and it was pretty clear that, I mean, it looked like she had read at least 80 to 90% of your complete work.
In 3 years. I know, raise your hand, where are you? I've forgotten your name. She's retired and she started reading. I don't know if you can see her. I can't see her because the lights are all here in my face.
But you must run into like a fair number of like sort of super fans like that who have just sort of, you know, dived in and read the whole, like,
oh, and God
David
bless
McCumber
them.
Library.
Yeah, you're keeping me in yarn, ladies. Yes. By the way, I can't really see, but can you raise your hand if you brought knitting tonight? Oh, thank you. I can see a couple
I
of
see
hands.
A hand, few, few
yeah,
hands
that's
there.
That is so great. So great. The real my career took off when I combined those passions of writing and knitting. That was really the one thing, you know, it was a gradual climb, but when I started the Blossom Street series, the shop on Blossom Street, it just spiked. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it was authentic with me. I mean, there are authors out there who decided, oh, I'll write a knitting book, but they weren't really knitters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can tell when somebody is jumping onto a sort of like a trend in fiction.
Yes.
That it's like, oh, you know, like whether it's like, oh, vampires are popular now, or oh, you know, like 50 Shades type romances or, you know, relationships are popular. I can write one of those, yeah, and cash in. And it's like you can always tell when somebody is like genuinely interested in that type. I mean,
yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, we were talking about.
I'm not writing 50 Shades.
No. I was circling back to what I was saying about Amish fiction before. Yeah. It's that it's like, I mean, you can tell when somebody is clearly writing like an Amish romance, yeah, just because they know that Amish romances sell, and they don't actually get.
Early in my career, I read a book by a man by the name of Jack Trout, and it's called The 21 Immutable Laws of Marketing. And one of the main, the one thing that I've really stuck in my mind was be first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I have been first in a lot of things. And it's just because, like, who flew over the Atlantic first? Do you know? Lindbergh.
Okay. Yep. Well, I was trying to see if it was a trick question.
No, it wasn't a trick question. But do you know who did it second?
Wrong Way Corrigan?
No.
No?
No,
okay.
That was football. No. I think.
Okay.
It was somebody whose name I've forgotten now, but he chose a faster route, used less fuel, was more efficient and smarter, but he was number two. And yeah, and that's why so many of the companies, you can only remember, also this is something else I remember from that book, the two products are the only things you can remember in your mind, everything else, so it's like Coke and Pepsi, and then everything else kind of fades out. So.
So now, so what do you do in your downtime? Do you have much downtime, I guess?
I do. In Florida right now, because Wayne and I are still in Florida, I walk the dog every morning. I'm just getting back to walking the dog. And we have a big social life. We're trying to catch up because I was, like I said, I was at 12 weeks in a cast. And yeah, and I do a lot of things with my kids. I didn't want my grandkids to grow up. We have 9 now, and without knowing me, because I didn't know my grandmothers, you know. And yet I know that they had a powerful influence in my life, just like my Grandma Adler. But so I started Grandma Camp. So every summer I take the granddaughters, Wayne takes the grandsons, and we do fun things together. I shared my passion with them. I took them to the town Yakima, where I was born and raised. I've taken them to New York. Last year, two of the girls went to Kenya with me. So they have this wonderful time, and I'm so close to them all. But I love being with my grandkids. And when we're in Port Orchard, we have every Sunday, we have one of the families over. So family's important to me.
Cool. Well, that seems like a very good point at which to sort of like turn over the questioning to you, because I'm sure that all of you have plenty of questions that you would like to ask Debbie. And I believe that there are people in the aisles who will have microphones. And now the lights are adjusting.
Hi, I'm so glad you're here. I've been a fan for a very long time, and I'm a knitter. I brought my knitting with me. How often do you get to sit down for 5 minutes to knit?
I knit every day. It's the end of the day. That's what I do. I pick up my knitting. Wayne and I watch Jeopardy every night. That's our one thing that we do every single night together. And I always knit through Jeopardy. By the way, I don't know how many of you know this, but you know, one of the things people ask me is if what the pinnacle of my career was. It was making the Times list, making number one on the hardcover. What it was when I was an answer on Jeopardy. Yes. I actually wrote a devotion about that because I figured if I could be an answer on Jeopardy, maybe God wanted me to be an answer to something else. Yeah.
Did you knit what you're wearing tonight?
No, this is not knitted.
Okay.
I have very few things that I've knit for myself. I almost always give things away. It's an expression of love and gratitude for me.
Thank you again. For
yeah. Me. Oh, my pleasure, really. Yeah.
Looks like there's a question at this end.
Hi, my name is Lisa, and you mentioned earlier that you're a self-taught writer, so I'm wondering for beginner and novice writers if you can impart some wisdom yourself as a what you learned, the most significant things as a self-taught writer. And question number two is, which one of your books would you say that your faith shines through the most?
Ah, okay. Well, I can tell you what I did when I first started, because like I said, I didn't know another writer in the world. But there were certain books that I loved so much that I would read them again and again and again. And there was one that I had read so often I'd memorized the first page. And so I sat down and I dissected those books, because whatever was in there that drew me back again and again, I wanted in my own books. So I took four books and I went through them scene by scene, chapter by chapter, and I outlined them. And in the process, I learned about structure. I learned about how to tell a story, how to bring in backstory, how to start a chapter, how to end a chapter. And so that was just sort of my apprenticeship kind of to get going. And then I just started writing. I outlined my own book and went for it. And I don't know which book I would say my faith shines through the most. I think every book, I would hope it would be.
Hi, I am Michelle. I just want to thank you very much for coming, because I have read your books, watched the shows, thought about you and how you write, but I want to say that you are truly an inspiration, because I didn't know anything about your life, and now I am completely in awe of you. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Wow.
Well, I think that's a perfect note with which to end this evening. You are an inspiration. Thank you for coming to Traverse City. And Ron, thank you for being the host for this evening. Both of them will be in the lobby. Debbie will be signing her books. So let's go, and we can visit more in the lobby. Thank you very much.
That was Debbie Maycomber talking with Ron Hogan. Maycomber is the author of over 150 novels, including the Cedar Cove series. Her latest book is Last One Home. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.